I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver. This is thecommentary.ca. Dan Gardner joins me again. He is the author of a new book, Future Babble, Why Expert Predictions Fail and Why We Believe Them Anyway. I'm reading the book now, and it's awfully thought-provoking and often surreal. We seem to want experts in every field to predict what's going to happen in the future, whether it's this weekend's weather forecast, the economy in a year, the state of the world for our children. And with research on psychology, political science, and behavioral economics, more often than not, the average expert, as seen on television, as heard on radio, as read in the newspaper, or on the internet, is no more accurate than a flip coin. Mr. Gardner was last on for his book Risk, which was a bestseller. Like that book, this one is a challenging, fascinating read. Dan Gardner is a senior writer and columnist at the Ottawa Citizen, as well as a popular public speaker who holds degrees in law and history. The website for more is dangardner.ca. Future Babble is published by McClelland and Stewart. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, Dan Gardner. Good morning, Mr. Gardner.
Hello, Mr. Plata.
Thanks for joining us.
Glad to do it.
I'm probably the only person who's interviewing you on this book tour who actually bought the book. And I did so a day ago, so unfortunately I haven't finished it yet. But from what I read, this is not just a bunch of thoughts or hunches that you have. There was a great deal of research that went into it, didn't it?
Oh, absolutely. One of the problems when you deal with expert predictions is it's a very simple problem. How good are expert predictions? I could fill a book with nothing but failed expert predictions, predictions that flop so badly that actually they're pretty funny in hindsight. In fact, many books have been filled with flopped forecasts,
yeah.
But I really wouldn't be proving anything because, of course, I'd just be cherry-picking anecdotes. Well, then I could come along and I could say, well, I could add in forecasts that worked, predictions that worked. Well, still I wouldn't be proving anything because I wouldn't know anything but the rate at which forecasts succeed or fail. The way to get at it is to do a proper experiment. And it's an extremely complex experiment. And fortunately, there is a researcher who has done this work. A researcher named Philip Tetlock, he's a psychologist at the University of California, did by far the most comprehensive experiment ever conducted on forecasting. And what he did was he went out and he assembled almost 300 experts. These are political scientists, economists, journalists, people who are basically paid to forecast the future. And he had them do predictions. He said, you know, what's going to happen to the inflation rate over the next 2 years? What's going to happen to the unemployment rate? Will there be an election? Who will win the election? All the usual stuff. And he asked so many of these predictions that in sum, he came up with almost 30,000 predictions from his 300 experts. He let time pass, and he went back and he assessed them properly to see what their accuracy rate was. And what he found was the average expert was no more accurate than a flipped coin.
And what do you think that says about us? I mean, let's just take the state of the media, for example, that needs, I guess, these experts to fill program slots and the sort. There is a psychological need for certainty, though, isn't there?
Oh, absolutely. And that psychological need for certainty is really what's fueling all of this. Uncertainty, not knowing what's going to happen, is a deeply aversive state. We do not like uncertainty. In fact, that state of uncertainty is so psychologically aversive that it can actually be a bigger burden to think that something bad may happen than to believe that something bad will happen. There was one fascinating experiment in which researchers asked volunteers to submit to electric shocks. One group was told, you will receive 20 strong electric shocks. The other group was told, you will receive 17 mild electric shocks, but interspersed among them will be 3 strong electric shocks. And the researchers tested for the standard physiological responses to fear, the indicators of fear, the respiration rate, heart rate, sweaty palms, that sort of thing. And what they found is that the people who were told you will get 20 strong electric shocks experienced considerably less fear than the people who were told you'll get 17 moderate shocks plus 3 strong ones. And the reason for that is because the people, of course, the people who got the 17 modest shocks with 3 strong ones didn't know what the next shock would be. They were uncertain. They couldn't predict. And so they experienced more fear. So people are really strongly compelled to go out and try and make sense and try and figure out what's coming next. We love nothing more than to hear from somebody who has impressive credentials, who is articulate, who is confident, who tells a good story, and who says, I know what's going to happen next. We love that. And the media, frankly, are simply just giving us what we demand.
Now, are our brains wired for a certain way to think, or do you think we've been conditioned over the years?
Oh, no. I think that this goes to some very, very deep-rooted psychology that has to do with, don't forget, one of the fundamental aspects of human nature is the ability to foresee and to plan ahead. This is an extremely advantageous thing. It's evolutionarily hardwired because it works. Generally, the problem is that there's all sorts of uncertainty in reality, uncertainty that simply cannot be eliminated. And so when we bump up against that uncertainty, we say, that's not good enough. I've got to know. I've got to figure this out. And unfortunately, that's the point at which we start to embrace some pretty crazy notions. For example, now, expert predictions are only one way that we can get the certainty that we crave. Other research has shown, for example, that in conditions of heightened uncertainty, people are more likely to embrace superstition, for example, and they're more likely to embrace dogmatic forms of religion, religion that says we absolutely are sure that we know what the answer is. That's how compelling this psychological need for certainty is.
It's become an industry, has it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, expert forecasting, expert predictions, there are huge industries devoted to this. A simple example, I have a full chapter on oil. Oil forecasting is an industry in itself. There are huge amounts of money involved. And this is despite the fact that oil forecasters have tried and failed to forecast the price of oil pretty much for ever since oil became an industrial commodity in the late 19th century, one mistake after another after another. In London, I had the good fortune to interview Lord John Brown, the legendary former head of British Petroleum, and he said quite frankly to me, he said, well, first, really senior people in the oil industry simply don't believe that they can predict the price of oil. And secondly, he said, and I thought this was wonderful, he said, look, I can tell you with considerable confidence that the price will vary. But beyond that, it's all gossip.
Yeah. I listen to Don Imus regularly, and because he's simulcast on the Fox Business Network, there's a lot of speculation as to job numbers or housing starts and the sort, and that's reported ad nauseum. Hasn't this all been happening, though, since the beginning time, before 24-hour cable news?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, fortune tellers, astrologers, the Oracle of Delphi, human beings have always been trying to look into the future because of this psychological compulsion that we have. Now, the problem is that, thanks to our media, of course, you can get this in torrents. And business news is probably the best example of this. If you look at the talking heads on business news who are telling you this will happen, that will happen, look at how extraordinarily confident they are. They never say that something may happen or they're not sure or there's countervailing circumstances. They're always certain of themselves. They're also filled with confidence. And yet you have to ask, if they were as accurate as they are confident, wouldn't they all be billionaires?
Yeah.
And billionaires don't do television, do they?
Yeah.
Now, here's a critical point, too. Coming out of Phil Tetlock's research, now, you remember I mentioned that the average expert in that experiment was no more accurate than a flip coin. Mm-hmm. But bear in mind, I'm only referring to the average there. There was actually a distribution of accuracy in those experts. And one of the critical messages that comes out of that research is that some experts were more accurate than a flip coin. They still weren't very good at predicting the future, but they were better than random guesses. But there were other experts that, believe it or not, were actually even worse than random guesses. And what Tetlock did was he crunched the numbers in an amazing analysis, and he found that a number of factors made no difference. Whether they were left-wing or right-wing made no difference. Whether they were optimists or pessimists made no difference. whether they had the best educations, whether they were affiliated with the best universities, whether they had access to classified information. None of that made any difference. The one thing that made a difference was thinking style. And Tetlock basically broke it down into two distinctive thinking styles, which he labeled foxes and hedgehogs based on the old Isaiah Berlin essay. He said foxes are basically those that they like to get information from lots of different sources. They don't have one big idea overriding their thinking. They like to use different models, different analysis, and they're also very comfortable with uncertainty. Foxes are comfortable with saying, I think this may happen, but I'm not sure. But hedgehogs, on the other hand, they have one big idea, and they use that one big idea as their analytical tool over and over again to stamp out predictions. And the other aspect about hedgehogs, because they have that one big idea which they are sure is true, they are far more likely to be confident, and they're far more likely to be insistent upon delivering a final, clear, certain answer.
Who are some hedgehogs?
Well, hedgehogs, I would say Jeff Rubin, the CIBC economist, mm-hmm. who's very big on peak oil, and all of his forecasts are based on that. That's classic hedgehog thinking. And what's interesting is that when you compare the hedgehogs and foxes, to go back to Tetlock's research, the hedgehogs did much worse than other experts. The foxes did better on average. And what's really disturbing, and this is where it's almost eerie, is that Tetlock then looked at the media, because he said to himself, well, hang on, what do you see in the media? You don't see experts who say, well, on the one hand, on the other hand, maybe this is going to happen, I'm not sure. No, what you see are super confident people who say they know what's going to happen. You see hedgehogs. And so what Tetlock did was he looked at the profile, the fame of his experts, and then he compared it to their accuracy rates. And what he found is the more famous the expert was, the less accurate they were.
So who's a fox then? I'm trying to think of someone like a non-famous expert on TV. You don't see very many of those, do you?
Well, and that's the thing. The foxes, I do discuss some in my book, but foxes tend not to be so famous because they don't deliver the things that you need to get a best-selling book, to become a talking head on TV, to get your own TV show. But a good example of a fox, I would suggest, is George Soros, the billionaire financier, who his success in the financial world is sort of a testament to his good judgment. If you look at his analysis of himself, he's a very introspective man, which is another feature of fox thinking. He thinks about his own thinking a lot. And he's actually, when he talks about, he's often asked, George, why are you so good? How do you get it right when so many get it so wrong? He typically says, it's because I know I'm human and I know I'm bound to make mistakes, and so I'm constantly thinking about my own thinking, and that makes me more likely to catch my mistakes. And that's a classic Fox statement. He's not saying, I'm getting these right answers because my ideas are right. Everybody listen to me. No, he's saying, he's pretty humble about it. And that's critical. And that's critical to good decision making.
Where are you on the cancellation of the long-form census?
Oh, I don't even think it's an issue. I think it's a lunatic decision.
Yeah, I mean, people a lot of the people who are complaining about it seem to be people who would use it to sort of, I guess, fuel their expertise in certain areas or mm-hmm. certain subjects. Do you think that that's the case?
Oh, we need, if you're going to be making good decisions, you need good facts. Absolutely, they have to be informed.
Yeah. How about climate change? We hear a lot about how dire it is.
Yeah.
From so-called experts.
Mm-hmm.
Is it?
Here's my take on climate change. I come at it a little bit differently than most people. I divide it into two parts. There's climate change as an observed phenomenon now. And then there's climate change as what will happen in the future and what its ramifications will be. If you go to a climate scientist now, and you say, what about climate change as an observed phenomenon now, they will say with a very high degree of confidence, in fact, there's a consensus in that field, it's real, it's happening, and it's serious. okay? And that's good enough for me. But then, when you talk about forecasting into the future, and of course they have enormous elaborate models for doing this, if you speak to scientists on a frank level, they will be quite upfront and say, look, there are enormous uncertainties in our models. And so the confidence, the level of confidence they have in climate change as an observed phenomenon now is far higher than their confidence in the accuracy of their forecasts about climate change in the future and what its ramifications will be. Now, whenever I make this point, some people say, oh, well, you're arguing in favor of doing nothing, right? If you acknowledge uncertainty, this means you're arguing in favor of doing nothing. And that's simply wrong. It is quite uncertain whether next year my home will burn down. But that doesn't mean that I should not buy fire insurance, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's my argument with climate change. I think that acknowledging the uncertainties, the enormous uncertainties about what the implications of climate change will be, actually strengthens the argument for action on climate change.
So how can the media consumer, the news consumer, be more savvy, do you think?
Well, the first thing I would advise is memory. Remembering things helps an awful lot. The media have a real problem with not remembering things. We forget things. I mean, we forget news older than a week. So, for example, when you have experts who come along and they tell you that China is going to overtake the United States in the next couple of decades and it will become the dominant economy, and they have all sorts of figures and they have a good story and it's all very compelling, it's very, very good if you remember that the same experts 20 years ago were saying that Japan would overtake the United States and become the world's number one economy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's even better if you remember that in the early 1960s, if you opened up an introductory economics textbook, you would have found a chart showing growth rates in the Soviet economy and the American economy, which showed that the Soviet Union would overtake the American economy around 1985. So if you remember that series of spectacular expert forecasting flops, that kind of gives you a strong indication that maybe you should be skeptical about the forecast that you're hearing now.
And I notice in your columns you rarely make predictions. Is that on purpose?
I try to avoid it. It's hard. It's hard. As I say, to predict is very much human nature. To embrace somebody else's predictions or to make predictions yourself, it's very much part of human nature. But, you know, I constantly have to remind myself, you know, when I'm thinking, will there be an election and who will win, no matter how strongly I feel that something is true, I just have to remind myself, you know, a whole lot of other experts have felt equally strongly about their predictions, and they were all wrong, so maybe I should be skeptical about my own feelings, too.
Do you readily do corrections in the sort of year-end columns where you talk about where you're wrong?
You know, that's a great practice. Jeffrey Simpson of the Globe and Mail does that, and I really admire him for doing that. But, you know, to the best of my knowledge, and I hope my readers will correct me if I'm wrong, I avoid predictions so rigorously that I'm seldom proved wrong because I avoid them in the first place.
What's next for you, Dan?
I don't know. I'm probably going to pursue this work on psychology and its intersection with public policy and politics. You know, both my previous book, Risk, and Future Babble, the foundations are, you know, basic psychology, cognitive psychology, and social psychology, and how it applies to the media and how it applies to politics and public policy. It's an area which is surprisingly little explored. I can't emphasize enough how important psychology is, basic psychology is, when you're trying to understand what the media do, what politicians do, how we make policy, public policy, what the public policy should be. And I've actually been startled quite often. I often lecture to groups of civil servants, politicians, intelligence officials, all sorts of folks. And I've been actually quite startled at how often very senior people actually have no background in psychology at all. They do not know the basics of psychology. If you do not know the basics of psychology, you are vulnerable to making some really egregious errors. And I can't emphasize strongly enough for folks, if you're in the business of making decisions, you have to learn some psychology.
Did the reception to Risk, did that surprise you? I mean, that was a big hit, wasn't it?
Yeah, it really was. I think part of the reason for that is, number one, a lot of people get the idea that, holy cow, it's one fear after another that doesn't seem to materialize, but then we're on to the next big fear. But more importantly, I think that people really appreciated just what I was talking about, the importance of psychology. It's one thing to say, oh, look at people, aren't we silly, and don't we make mistakes? It's far more interesting to talk about the origins of those mistakes in psychology. Because when you lay bare the origins in psychology, then you can start to talk about catching and correcting those mistakes.
Dan, I've enjoyed the conversation, and I'm going to enjoy this book once I finish it, I'm sure. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
The website's for more, dangardner.ca. The book is called Future Babble, Why Expert Predictions Fail and Why We Believe Them Anyway. It's published by McClelland & Stewart. Its author, Dan Gardner, on the line here from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.